Letters and Sayings of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, into the book Peak of Eloquence. His dedication to preserving the teachings and wisdom of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, has ensured that future generations have access to the profound insights and spiritual guidance found within Nahjul Balagha. All of this is presented to you in the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio.
Now, when we say that a believer's sadness is long, is lengthy, it doesn't mean that the believer is not energetic. It doesn't mean that a believer is depressed. You see, that type of sadness and grief that removes energy from you, that decapitates you, that incapacitates you, is what is not liked. But there is a type of grief that a person has that actually encourages a person to do good. And because this type of grief is compatible with truth, it's compatible to haqq. And a human being is always pleased, is always happy, is always, you can say, in a state of ecstasy when he is in conformity with the truth. So what is important is that that emotional state should be in compatibility with truth. As long as it is compatible with truth, that person is in a state of energy, is in a state of strength and goodness and well-being. Inshallah, we shall develop this discussion in the coming session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Have perished, or I'm in need. My soul is empty, I need to find. How do we spend these days and lonely nights? In my sujood, I call to you to ease this hardship, this journey has put me through. In my sujood, I call to you. You ease my pain. I only find my peace through you. In my sujood, in my sujood, in my sujood. You are my guidance, my source of hope. You see my tears and how they fall. I feel the greatness of your love. Please have mercy on my soul, O Allah.
good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. We are very glad to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Inventions that emerge from the Islamic world include the discovery of Critic acid, Jaber ibn Hayyan, architecture, the minaret, the bridge mill, the vertical axle windmill, teaching hospitals, marching bands, early torpedoes, the guitar, the lute, the water pipe, also known as hookah, early attempts at gliding, algebra, the pinhole camera, the laws of refraction of light in optic, coffee, and more. Muslim scholar Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes, Kepler, and Isaac Newton. You are listening to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start this hour's lineup with A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. They will be followed by our varied radio productions feature. And we finish off this hour's programs with Muslim Lady, the quintessential radio program for Muslim women. The program deals with a variety of subjects in relation to Muslim women. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, helping others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z. With me, Sister Zainab here on IB English Radio. And so the title is Helping Others. And I'm just referring initially to a particular incident from the life story of the famous Mahdi Ibrahim Hadi. So Ibrahim Hadi himself, in this little story, was actually still on crutches from an injury. And so, but what he was doing at the same time, so he was trying to help someone he knew who was a teacher to get a job, because this teacher had had big problems actually being hired. So even though Ibrahim Hadi was still in crutches, he was in this, presumably the building of the Department of Education. And he was going up and down the staircases on his crutches, in and out of different offices. And when he was asked, well, why are you doing this? You're on crutches. He said that this man had asked for his help, and secondly, that a man must do anything he can for the servants of God, and especially the good people that we have. And, you know, this is, so there's, in a sense, there's three things in here, three aspects that are quite important that maybe all of us need to bear in mind. So obviously, first element here is that Ibrahim Hadi had been asked for help. So, and we've probably heard this many times. If someone asks us for help, if we at all have the capacity, we really are obligated to try to help, you know, if we're able to. And if not, it's really good if we just say to the person, oh, look, I'm not able to because such and such. And to be honest, and if we can then say to that person, well, look, I can't help you with this, but I know someone else. So if we can even refer them to someone else who can do that, provide that help, now that would be really good, inshallah. Welcome back. This is AZ and IB English Radio. And so I'm talking about helping others. And so I mentioned the story from the life of Ibrahim Hadi, who was helping a young teacher to get some kind of employment, basically, and was on crutches running up and down the staircases in the Department of Education, and then explained that obviously when we're asked, when someone asks us to help, we do what we can. And, you know, if we can't help, we're then able to even find someone to help that person. And then second very important element, what Ibrahim Hadi said, and I said it's quite astonishing how obviously our martyrs are able to sort of separate out some of these really important concepts in some of the statements they make. So A, the one condition is we're being asked. The second condition which he mentions here is that, you know, for the servants of God, so for the fellow Muslims, for fellow believers, you know, we should try to do whatever we can. You know, so this is, and obviously we know that in general we should be helpful also to non-Muslims. But obviously this is a particular onus. If we know this is a really good person, a pure-hearted person, a hard-working servant of Allah, well, you know, there's the duty, the obligation for us to help is even stronger. And then, and obviously Ibrahim Hadi has sort of almost mentioned a third aspect, because he says, especially these good people that we have. So in a sense, he's almost going up a level. So maybe in those that particular time, there were then amongst the servants of, because obviously the servants of God, and inshallah, it's all of us Muslims. But then he's also saying, well, look, there's those amongst all of us servants of God who are really, really worthy. So inshallah, that's just a little, I would say, just a little onus, a little, I don't know, invitation. Let's call it an invitation, not a kick, definitely not. But a little invitation for all of us to think about, well, how else can we help people? If people are asking us for help, if we can't, do we always remember to maybe think about whether someone else can actually help that person, inshallah? So, inshallah, you've gained just a few extra insights or reminders from today, and look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of Aid Said here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
On a humid August morning in Washington, a blurry photograph began circulating online. It appeared to show Europe's top leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, Friedrich Merz, among others, slouched in the White House hallway, heads bowed, waiting for their turn with Donald Trump. AI hoax or a real snapshot of Europe's posture in the 21st century? In truth, it almost doesn't matter. Because the image told a larger truth. Europe's role in the so-called Western alliance has shrunk to something more like obedient accompaniment, a junior partner awaiting instructions. And nowhere is that clearer in the case of Iran's nuclear program. Since World War II, the transatlantic partnership has been dressed up as a strategic alliance. In reality, it's been a structure of dependence. America rebuilt Western Europe through the Marshall Plan, but in exchange, it locked the continent into its economic orbit. Washington pressured Europeans to shift from coal to American-supplied oil. It pushed its corporations into Europe's reconstruction, and through NATO, established in 1949, it cemented its military primacy, with Europe's defense forever under U.S. command.
Everybody was celebrating but us. And we're the ones that won the war. We won the war. And they helped. But without us, they don't win the war. We're all speaking German. You know that, right? Without us, they're speaking German. Maybe a little Japanese, too.
For decades, this arrangement worked as long as Europe's prosperity grew. But the price hasn't always been clear when it comes to the big questions, war and peace, sanctions and diplomacy, allies and adversaries, Europe defers to Washington. We saw it in Iraq in 2003, when Britain went along despite massive domestic opposition, while France and Germany's dissent quickly softened. We saw it again after 2022 in Ukraine, where sanctions on Russia devastated Europe's own energy markets and industry far more than America's. And now, in 2025, we see it once more in the European Troika's decision to activate the so-called snapback mechanism under the Iran nuclear deal. On August 29th, Paris, Berlin, and London announced that they would move to reimpose all United Nations sanctions on Iran, sanctions that had been lifted under the 2015 JCPOA. A deal painstakingly negotiated over Tehran's nuclear program. The timing is not accidental. Just 2 months earlier, in June, the United States and Israel carried out coordinated strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. Costly, dangerous, illegal, and inconclusive, Iran's program, though damaged, survived. And so, in a perfect division of labor, the Europeans stepped in with the legal and diplomatic hammer.
Good morning. Yesterday, in accordance with UN Security Council Resolution 2231, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and my own country, the United Kingdom, notified the Security Council that we believe Iran to be in significant non-performance of its commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
The message to Tehran was blunt. Negotiate directly with Washington or face the return of the toughest international sanctions. Yes, the Europeans dangle an extension of the deadline. But let's be clear that if Iran agrees to direct talks with the United States, is no concession. It's a demand for surrender, and perhaps more striking than the ultimatum itself is what it reveals about Europe's self-image, or the lack of one.
The European countries must act honestly and responsibly, considering the history of negotiations, considering what they have themselves agreed as part of their commitments under Resolution 2231, to review their positions and strive to adopt an independent approach, free from influence from two other destructive actors, the Zionist regime and the United States of America.
Europe never lived up to its JCPOA commitments after Washington walked away in 2018. INSTEX, the mechanism designed to shield trade with Iran from U.S. sanctions, never worked. European companies fled Iran overnight, terrified of American penalties. So the notion that Europe now holds leverage, that it can dictate terms, is more theater than reality. But this theater has a director, and he sits in Washington. Marco Rubio, Trump's Secretary of State, admitted it outright. In an August 28th statement, he confirmed that Europe's snapback move was taken under direct guidance from the White House, citing National Security Memorandum No. 2, signed by Trump in February. In other words, the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Britain were not making independent policy. They were executing Washington's orders. This is not diplomacy, it is subordination. And the Iran case is hardly unique. Think back. When the NSA was caught wiretapping Angela Merkel's phone in 2013, Europe grumbled, then swallowed the insult. When negotiations over a transatlantic trade pact tilted heavily toward U.S. corporations, Europe signed anyway. And when secondary American sanctions forced European banks and firms out of Iran in the past decade, Brussels could do little more than issue statements of regret. Today, Europe finds itself once again reduced to enforcer of Washington's agenda, even as the costs mount at home. Its energy prices soared because of U.S.-driven sanctions on Russia. Its industries now face investment flight to the United States, where cheaper gas and subsidies lure away factories and jobs. Strategic autonomy, the buzzword in Brussels for years, looks more like strategic illusion. The irony is that while Europe diminishes itself, the rest of the world is moving on. New alignments are taking shape across Eurasia. Russia, China, Iran, and others building networks of trade, energy, and security that bypass the West entirely. In this multipolar order, credibility is currency. And on Iran, Europe has squandered it. For Tehran, the EU is no longer a trustworthy partner. Deals signed with Europeans turn to dust the moment Washington disapproves. The commercial space once available to Airbus, Siemens, or Total is now occupied by Chinese and Russian competitors. And diplomatically, Europe is seen not as a mediator, but as an extension of U.S. power, irrelevant as an independent player. Donald Trump, never one to mince words, put it plainly this February from the White House. Let's be honest, the European Union was formed to screw the United States. His vice president, J.D. Vance, speaking in Munich days earlier, was even blunter. America can do nothing for you, and there is nothing you can do for the American people. Harsh rhetoric? Yes. But look at Europe's behavior, and it almost validates the contempt. When leaders bow, literally or figuratively, in the White House corridor, what message does that send about sovereignty, about relevance? Europe's snapback decision against Iran is not about Iran alone. It's a symptom of something larger, a continent that no longer believes in its own capacity to shape the world, that no longer takes risks on its own principles, that no longer acts except through the shadow of American approval. The photograph, real or fake, of European leaders waiting for Trump may have been a hoax, but it captured something true. The waiting room has become Europe's place in global politics. Unless Europe rediscovers autonomy, invests in its own security, and reclaims diplomatic initiative, it risks becoming not a pole in a multipolar world, but a relic remembered only as Washington's loyal lieutenant. And for Iran, for Russia, for China, for the global South, the conclusion is already drawn. Europe is not an independent actor. It is an instrument. That is the reality behind the snapback mechanism. That is the story of Europe in 2025. For all the talk of the Western Alliance, the truth is simpler and starker. There is no West. There is America, and there are its followers.
Thank you. I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service, and in here I have a very dear friend, Sister Nasreen, and I would love her to introduce herself at the very beginning of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum, Sister, and welcome.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for inviting me here so that you could listen to my opinion, allow me to give my opinion and my ideas. I don't know what you want me to say. I'm from England and I live here. Mm-hmm. And I'm always ready to discuss Islamic issues.
Very good. That's all what we need in here in Muslim Lady, which is all related to the concerns of ladies from all around the world. So wherever you are, I hope you're doing well and everything is just so okay with you. What does it mean to stand beside someone, not just in times of joy, but in storms of life, in an age where promises are broken as quickly as they are made? What does it mean to be loyal? And this question of loyalty becomes so at a stake, even more than before, right now.
I think that we approach all ethical and moral issues from the back door instead of from the front door.
Yeah, in what ways?
And if we were more serious about our loyalties to Allah, the Holy Prophet, mm-hmm. and the Ahlul Bayt in practice, then we wouldn't have to question loyalty, because it's a part of the spirit, it's a part of the fitra, yeah. to be loyal. But the problem is that we, as according to the hadith, it says that by the akhirah zaman, the time where the reappearance comes close, there will be no spirit of Islam left, only performance.
Yeah.
And
it will be all deviated from the right track.
There won't be spirit. Mm-hmm. And if you compare this, when was the other time that was like that? Right after Karbala. That's not a good sign, you know, because their spirit was gone. Imam Zain al-Abidin, alayhi salam's time, there was no Islam anywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, just because we're performing Islam, we're performing the jurisprudential matters, that's not the human self,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. So until we feed our heart and our spirit, connect the heart with the basira, open the basira in
the
third
inside.
Eye,
yeah.
we won't have a divine alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, we don't have to question loyalty, right?
Yeah.
But we also have to... You see, what keeps the heart alive is vibration. Mm-hmm. The soul understands vibration. So the Quran is the food, the first food for the soul. And it goes through the ear. Imam yeah. Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam said that the ear is the channel through which various concepts reach the heart, right?
Yeah.
When we listen to the Quran, when we recite the Quran, that is bringing the heart to life.
Mm-hmm.
And that really essentially solves loyalty. Then we connect to the Ahlul Bayt,
mm-hmm.
right? We are not performing our daily ziyarat.
That's the problem. The problem is...
Our daily ziyarat for the Ahlul Bayt are the way that we do not oppress the day, because they are the days.
Yes.
Right? They said so. We mm-hmm. are the days.
So, you know, in today's life, as you already aware... media is there, the propagandas are out there, everybody is working against the right track, and then media has got its effects, even movies, whatever that's out there and created by this propaganda is working and it's doing its own job. So the concept of loyalty and commitment becomes something that needs to be clarified more and more. We go for a break, stay tuned, and we'll be back.
¶¶
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Maybe in past, the concept of loyalty meant was actual the equal of endurance. And that was a little bit of different from what you were just talking about at the very beginning.
Equal endurance?
In past, loyalty meant endurance. Like, you endure whatever that happens to you under whatever circumstances. That was loyalty.
That's not how I understand loyalty. Loyalty means being true, standing by... being in the camp of Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Right? That's loyalty.
But you already said it. See, in past, maybe people were so tuned with those ideologies. But right now, as you have said it, people are getting away from it.
Okay, so like we want to find the path back. We don't want to put bandages on.
So where did you start it from?
You start, I said, you start with Imam Ja'far Sadiq. He said 50 verses of Quran a day is the right of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
You don't connect to the 50 verses of Quran, you're not guided. Because your heart is misaligned, is going to be taken over by the gravity, which is society.
Mm-hmm.
The pull, the negative pull of society on our heart is too much for us to fight alone. Allah says, hold on to the rope. What is the rope? The rope is two. The rope is the thakalin.
But does everybody listen to that?
Okay, because they're not taught how, maybe. You know, it's not about, yes, I believe in Imam Ali, and then on the Eid al-Ghadir, we, you know, rave and rant and give presents and this and that. That's not wilayat. No way that's wilayat. Wilayat is to
submit,
to connect. How do we connect to the Ahlul Bayt? With our heart. How do the ziyarat? When you do ziyarat, are the imams so rude that they don't answer us back? Astaghfirullah. So when you speak to the imam is there. Ziyarat, you're visiting with the imam. We don't believe in the unseen. I remember once there was someone called Dr. Takim in Toronto, Jamaat. He said, we believe in Allah, but we don't believe Allah.
Yeah.
Right? And it's true. We don't believe in the unseen. We go to doctors when we're sick. Okay, Allah told Musa alayhi salam, when Musa alayhi salam asked him, where is illness from? He said, me. Where is the cure from? He said, you know, myself.
Mm-hmm.
The body heals itself when it is in the right alignment with divine.
Yeah.
It is a system like the universe. But we don't believe in the Ahad. Okay, that's a problem. We don't believe in Ahad. We don't believe in unification of the self. Even how can we unify the ummah or anything, right? So we begin with the Quran, the ziyarats of the imam on their day, right? And on the special, and kissa, haditha kissa. Okay, you can't have a stable family being a mu'min and not say salam to the Ahlul Bayt on Wednesday. Wednesday is the day that I do it, but you know, other
devote
people.
A specific time for it.
Yeah, to yeah, exactly. And we don't have a system by which we calibrate and align ourselves with the divine. We mm-hmm. think that we can go from the brain reading books to the actions, but we're missing the third. We've lost our inner eye.
Yeah.
And our heart. Well, we're not going through the heart. We're going through the will.
When we talk about today's world, we're talking about tangible stuff. Like when they start talking about loyalty, it is something like mutual, that if he's not loyal to me, why would I? And if loyalty is this and that, so
the
is
secular,
all that compensation.
Secular mentality.
Yeah.
It's secular mentality. If we're going to carry on with secular mentality, don't even speak about Zuhur. Because you're not walking the path to the Zuhur.
Mm-hmm.
Zuhur is not some joke that you just wait for. Who are we waiting for to bring the Zuhur? We're waiting for someone to tell us, okay, he's come now. Come to where? If we're not loyal, we have to build loyalty. How do we build loyalty? First, what did Allah give first to man? The names.
Mm-hmm.
The names of Allah. How many people do this? you know, the dhikr.
Well, they're busy doing other stuff, like busy with the materialistic world.
Hmm?
They have to pay for the rent of the house. They have to pay for many bills, and that's why...
Yes, Allah says that if you... He said to Adam, alayhi salam, and he was a prophet, he said, live in this garden, but if you don't obey me, then I will make you fight for your life.
Yeah. Now that's
relatable. And now we're fighting. Houses, we can't even own property anymore. You can't be loyal if you don't establish a way to make your, you know, to align yourself with Allah, because you're going to be pulled by society.
Very
if
true.
Not you, your children.
Yeah, so now I have a question for you. Just imagine a woman living in this realistic, ordinary world that we all have, and we all are a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband is not loyal to her.
Okay.
So what do you recommend to her? And she's very loyal. She's having all these things that you're saying, like she keeps
practicing. Well, she's not. She might be superficially loyal, but maybe her connections are not made with the Ahlul Bayt. We think loyalty, just like some women think a very cruel claim
about this woman.
When you want to analyze things, you have to go back to the root.
Yeah, and you think the root of this is?
If it's a mu'min, if it's someone, okay, Allah doesn't treat the non-Muslim or the non-mu'min even. You know, a woman wearing hijab is not treated the same way in Allah's eyes as one who's not. Because one is a mu'min and one isn't.
Yeah.
Because Allah says, tell the believing women
mm-hmm.
to draw the veil upon their bosoms. So it's not about judgment. It's about finding the root cause, not looking at the symptoms.
Yeah.
A man that's not loyal is symptomatic of something in the woman that's not right. Recently, there was a man who complained that his wife was spending money. And no matter what he tried, and it was a very, very early time in the marriage,
mm-hmm.
before children, just married, and like ridiculous amounts of money. So then suddenly when I was praying, and I was thinking over it, it came to me. I said, she's spending your money because you're not giving her the love she needs.
Yeah, it's a way of projecting the need that
it
she
is
has.
Because a woman will go to spending when there's a void in the heart.
Yeah,
the woman is the heart of the man, but the man also has to, they have to meet in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
We can't marry for, if we marry for anything but love, and, you know, I don't mean emotion, I mean, love is a state, it's not an emotion, it's a state of being. If we marry anything, that we're betraying already. So we don't know when the betrayal began. Maybe it began. So they have to work to balance it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I gave a brother the program to do, and it was very dire situation, and it seems that it corrected it, because once you're aligned, once you're connecting, communicating with your living imam and your imams, they're guiding you, they're telling you how to behave, they're correcting. We don't believe that,
and the help would come from the beyond.
It has to come from Allah and the Prophet and the Imams.
Yeah.
And the Imam is the hub. He makes all the connections here. Go to him and he'll connect you to everything.
Yeah.
You know?
They are the rope through which
they are.
Yeah.
He's the hub. He's the spiritual Dubai in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, because
very
Dubai
true,
is,
yeah.
you know, really a
good
hub
analogy.
Now.
Well, I'm so afraid to say this, but we're running out of time already and time's already up. But I'm very hopeful that we could continue talking about loyalty in other episodes as well. So thank you, sister, very much for this very interesting episode of The Muslim Lady. And thank you, dear ladies, for staying with us. Until another episode, take care of yourself. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning to you all. You are tuned in to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and we are very glad to have you with us. I'm your host for the next hour. We'll start this hour's lineup with our radio productions feature. After that, we have Spotlight. This is a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. And we'll round up this hour's programs with Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. Stay with us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome to the program Islamic Awakening. Today is the sixth day that we are going to advocate the entire time to a special version of Islamic Awakening program with me. There are two dear guests, Sayyid Taghir Jafar Razavi. He's involved in Islamic propagation in the holy city of Qom. And Dr. Mahdi Turabi, a PhD from London School of Economic and also an active researcher in Qom and Tehran. Before we start, I would like to congratulate the whole Ummah of Islam on the happy occasion of the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Today is the last day, according to different version, of the birth of Prophet Muhammad, between 12 and 17th day of Rabiul Awwal. Congratulate to both of you brothers also. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brother Turabi, I would like to start with you. I promised something last time, that Islam, the way it is, the way we see it, is beautiful, is nice, is practical. We live it, we enjoy it. Why they, and by they I mean the enemy of Islam, Western societies in general, American administration in particular, why they are so scared of Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The answer to this question, you know, has many levels. It's not one reason. There are many reasons for it. So I'm just going to try to, you know, just give
Let's
it.
Let's go
yeah,
through
just,
the list.
Just generally
one by one.
Make a reference to some of the things which I think are the reasons why they are so scared of it. Number one is that, of course, Islam, if practiced properly, and of course we claim that it is the Islam as taught by Ahlul Bayt, which is the purest and the pinnacle of what Islam is. If practiced properly,
the way we're supposed to,
yes, endangers their material and worldly interests. This is a very simple thing. I mean, you have to look at it a little bit from their perspective. They have spent their entire life, all their energy, all their effort, everything in terms of their mental and physical power and ability to amass this power and this wealth, because they think this is going to bring them happiness, and they think this is going to make them good. And so when something comes that actually endangers this, they react in this way. And it has to do with their general view of
and
life.
From their point of view, this is a natural thing.
To them, it's like...
To them.
Yeah, to them, this is a natural reaction to somebody who's endangering their interests, or their wealth, or their power, or their status in the world, or the feeling that they have about themselves, about, you know, that we are the you know, the pinnacle of human civilization. There's, you know, we've
leader of free world.
We're leader of not only of all the world. We are and
the
you know,
entire if, universe. If
and if you want to put it in Quranic terms, they feel that they are God's Khalifa,
mm-hmm.
basically. Khalifa meaning they are God's
God
voice and representative on earth, and that they have the right to lead humanity.
Do they really believe that?
I'm saying that if you want to say it in religious language,
in
Quranic language.
Right.
But the basis of it is the same. They believe, given their history and the fact that, you know, Western civilization was able to triumph over other civilizations.
The first thing is, the issue is that it's about self-interest.
It's about the fact that they believe that their civilization is the pinnacle of human history.
They are superior.
That they have the most, you know, humans have never had such advanced technology, have never had so much, all the stuff that they claim to be the fruits of you know, their own genius.
And eventually it's going to become some kind of racism. I mean, like it or not.
Not eventually. It is racism.
It is.
It is, and it's part of that. So mm-hmm. basically, when you have the self-image of being the pinnacle of human history, and that you have the God-given right to rule humanity because of the things you supposedly have done, so anything that comes and threatens this, or questions this even, is threatening to you.
And the only main force that is questioning this, opposing this, is Islam. True Islam.
Exactly. And so, again, looking at it historically, looking at it from their perspective, looking at it civilizationally, these are the things that they feel that their entire way of life and the way they imagine humanity should be and should be governed is under question by a religion which says that it is the true program for the management of humanity. So this is one level of it. The other level of it is that basically you have demographic issues.
Which means?
Demographics means, you know, populations.
I understand, but in what way are you talking
about? Yes. Basically, what we had is we had a couple centuries where the demographic wave in the world was in favor of Western European societies.
Population.
You had overpopulation. These populations spread out. You had European demographic explosion.
Okay.
What happened is that that overpopulation then spread to other parts of the world, like the Americas, like Australia. And so this was part of the idea that Western race, Western civilization is the dominant one. We are now historically at a stage where there is a retreat of that demographic shift. You see that European ancestry populations are in decline in Europe and in North America, and other demographics, Asian demographics, Muslims, are in the increase.
And it would be interesting, Mr. Tarabi, to see the reason for that too. That's another program.
And the reason, one of the reasons for that is the fact that in Western civilization, having children has become a bad thing.
It's a burden.
It's a burden. It's not considered
view,
a blessing.
It's a ni'mah. It's a blessing.
Exactly. Whereas in Islam, we still maintain that having children, family, big family is a beautiful, wonderful thing.
And it is beautiful.
And it is a wonderful, beautiful thing.
And in the same,
yes,
in the same area, I mean, when you if I make back
of
in
course,
there,
of course.
The main thing is that one important issue is that where the West or where the enemies of Islam look at everything that they make as their own personal achievement.
Exactly.
Muslims are meant to assume it as God-given benefit.
Uh-huh.
It makes a lot of
and
difference.
And be
helps
thankful.
Them to use it in a better way.
Indeed.
Exactly.
Indeed it does.
And I just want to expand on this issue. You have now the very definition of virtue being shifted towards Muslims. There was a time where the very definition of virtue in the world, they would say, we are the virtuous. Our society, the way we live, we are civilized. We go and, you know, bring civilization to these jahil people. If
they
you
also say, hey, we are it.
Exactly. And in their and even if you look at Western civilization historically, there was a period in that civilization where they really did have they were more virtuous, where still the issue of family and children.
There was a time. Okay.
And this has all changed over the last 100-150 years, and we see that those things which are in their own civilization and culture and religion considered virtues mm-hmm. are no longer practiced by that society in general. There's always exceptions, but those things are now being practiced, generally speaking, by the Muslims. And this is a reality. This is not simply, you know, culture war
and
or, you know,
understand this.
Or conservative versus liberals. This
right.
is this is a reality. Virtue is a reality. This is
do
what God God tells us. These things are good things to do, and these things are bad things
mm-hmm.
to do. So if you live in a society where family has broken up, where the idea of having a personally moral life is no longer even valued, where the leaders are corrupt completely, where everything is falling apart, and then you have this ummah, this nation, this civilization, which is trying to live according
this
to these virtues.
This unique nation, when you're talking about ummah.
Trying to live according to these virtues in their personal life, and now, alhamdulillah, after the Islamic Revolution and this awakening, also in their social life, this is extremely threatening.
And you see, that's where ultimately the threat materializes in front
exactly.
of the observer.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they realize that up till now, they've used the reverse of it. In other words, the dividing of the Muslim Ummah for their benefit. The Muslim Ummah is realizing that, no, the division has not helped it in its statehood. But in fact, it has helped in exposing its resources to others.
I see.
That by uniting it, it's going to realize that the enemies are going to realize those resources are not going to be accessible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like the very fact that, you know, after Egypt immediately came into its present situation, it started analyzing the gas agreement with the Zionist state.
Mm-hmm.
So these are dangerous issues, you know, the resources. Then
or some political issues, for that matter.
Indeed.
It's not just from the economy point of view.
It is, because of the fact that
I'm referring to Camp David for that sense.
No, Camp David, but back home as well. Back home, if these countries become united, the very first example of them was this artificial unity under the title of OPEC,
mm-hmm.
where it was a very artificial pressure on the Western world, but it was really to fund the Shah's regime, because during those period of time, Shah was in fact giving oil to Israel.
Right.
So, you know, the increasing of the prices of petrol was going pocketing him in reality. But what's important is I wanted to bring back the ayat of unity into this point of our discussion. With the ayat number 103.
Why is unity is so important.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that is what frightens.
All right.
That is the main frightening force. For the enemies of Islam, where they know that there are beautiful factors.
Are you going to share some narrations from the Holy Prophet?
I will. But what I want to first say is that when you look at